Sermons from the Journey is an audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Rebecca Clark, pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Montpelier, Vermont, and blogging online at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
Grade, the first time I saw and then read the classic movie and novel, Gone with the Wind. As a child of the North, raised entirely in the North and entirely in the post-civil rights era, it was an interesting exposure to me to a totally different way of thinking about everything I'd ever been taught about the Civil War. Now, I'm not saying that it was right or undid what I had learned about slavery and segregation and injustice and the Reconstruction era and the pain and brokenness and brutality and downright evil that was perpetrated. But it was an interesting insight into a different part of society and into a different mindset. And I had to somehow hold in my heart this tension between everything I knew about slavery and prejudice and injustice that was still true, and this other way of thinking that gave me some insight into the minds and the hearts and the motivations of some of the captors in the scenario, and how their lives and love, their struggle, their triumph is still true and potent and valid, even though some of their actions are things I could not possibly condone or support. It is challenging, but somehow beautiful and liberating to try to hold those tensions together, to try to see through the eyes of another, through the eyes of someone that we might otherwise dismiss or even despise. This wonderful story from the book of Acts gives us insight into the motivations and experiences of people we would call oppressors. Not all of those motivations are good motivations or experiences that we can take and use and say, okay, we now can understand exactly where these people are coming from. The first example we're given are slaveholders. The first people we encounter who are oppressors in this story are the owners of a young girl who has somehow, through supernatural means, the power to tell the future. And this makes not her, this makes her owners very wealthy. This makes them very rich. So their motivation to take care of her at all is to keep themselves wealthy. And so when she is healed, from Paul and Silas's perspective and the perspective of the disciples, when she is healed and the spirit is driven from her, her oppressors, her captors, her owners get upset. And they don't get upset because, I don't know, she liked having this power and it was taken from her, or because they're concerned about her well-being. They get upset because they are going to lose money. And I love that the Bible is so explicit about this motivation for oppression, the fear of loss of power and wealth. How often that is the case. How often that kind of ignorance and selfishness leads people to oppress and to exploit others. And I love that we see that in bold relief here. There's no excuse made for that. These men are upset. These owners are upset. I presume they're men. That's a little sexist of me, perhaps. These owners are upset because their source of wealth has been eliminated. We think, for example, of the young women that Carmen lifted up during our prayer time and their oppressors, their captors, these women who lived for a decade or more as survivors of kidnapping and the violence and brutality that they endured through that experience. The motivations and experiences of those oppressors are not things we want to understand or have insight into. And so I'm not saying that each insight into the mind and heart of an oppressor or of a person who does cruel and violent and despicable things is something that we want to embrace. but that it is important to look into the hearts and minds of the people we might name enemy. But then there is another oppressor, another literal captor in this story, and that is the person who is the jailer at the prison. This guard who is given responsibility, it seems the sole responsibility for making sure that these rabble-rousers, who have been put in jail under some questionable circumstances because the motivations of the people accusing them are a little bit suspect, but these rabble-rousers who are going around and saying all these things that Romans aren't allowed to do, and he's been put in charge, this unnamed jailer has been put in charge of keeping them locked up as tightly as possible. And this is such an important and indeed in his culture sacred responsibility that failure to discharge his duty, failure to keep them properly locked up is punishable by death. And to save himself and his family the humiliation of his failure, he is prepared to take his own life upon learning that the doors of the jail are open and the shackles have fallen from the feet of the prisoners. This jailer is himself shackled and chained into a system where his actions are restricted, or at least he believes they are, by the forces around him. And we might initially dismiss him or disregard him or despise him for agreeing to and being complicit in this system in which people are being locked up and brutally beaten in punishment for kind of trumped up charges and who knows what. And so God breaks open the prison. And we see that as a miraculous moment, the ground shaking, the doors opening, the chains falling from people's feet, not just Paul's and Silas's, but all of the prisoners. And we have to suspect that some of them are in jail for something they did. But the chains fall from all of their feet, from all of them, and they are set free. But what they do with their freedom is important. What they do with their freedom is they stick around. These people who have been set free by a miraculous event stay right where they are. And when the jailer wakes up in fear and panic and prepares to take his own life out of humiliation for his failure, they say, "Wait, don't hurt yourself. Nobody's gone anywhere." Out of compassion, out of, dare we say, love for their captor, the prisoners, not just Paul and Silas, but all the prisoners who'd been listening to them sing the hymns of God, all of the prisoners stay right where they are and wait. And wait so that their captor might not lose his life. So that their captor might also be set free. This action is transformative for them, for him. This action is liberation for all of them, not only for the people who were chained to blocks of wood, but for the man who placed the chains there. The shackles that are broken, the chains that are loose, are not only the literal ones. That's a really cool trick. But the power of God is in breaking the shackles and the chains in their hearts that they might love their captor. And the shackles and chains of the system that holds that captor in place, until their very oppressor takes Paul and Silas with him and bathes them and cleans their wounds and invites them into his home in an act of hospitality and asks to learn more about their faith, about their God. That is the true miracle. That is the true breaking of chains. That is the true transformation. Taking a page from the theologian Karl Barth, I like to preach with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper, or what passes as a newspaper for me, some sort of electronic device, in the other. And Methodists have been in the news quite a bit this week, and it has touched me very personally, and I want to share with you. The first, and you may not know the Methodist connection in this one, the first way in which Methodists have been in the news this week has to do with the burial of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the elder of the two suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing. As you probably heard, there was a funeral for him in Worcester, Massachusetts, and there was great protest and struggle around that. But then nobody would receive his body. No cemetery would receive his remains. And there was protest, and there was disruption, and there was great unsettling, and it was unsettling to watch. It is not our best moment as humanity to deny a proper and religiously significant for him, for his Muslim family, burial, disposal of his remains. But a woman, quietly, contacted the Muslim community near her and got some more information and did some research and arranged for Tamerlan's body to be moved and to be buried in a cemetery, in a Muslim cemetery and ceremony, so that he could rest in whatever peace is permitted him and his family could have that grace and healing. This woman was seminary educated and trained. She was also a United Methodist. There is a United Methodist who gets what we are about, who gets and understands grace, who understands what it is to look into the heart and mind of someone who has done something violent and horrible and be able in some way to forgive and offer peace and grace. She makes me proud to be Methodist. The other story in the news this week makes me less proud, and yet proud and not, and conflicted. You've heard me speak about it. Similar situations before, but yet again, the Methodist Church finds itself in the place where we are charging someone with officiating a wedding for a same-gender couple. The pastor in this case was retired, a clergy person. Reverend Dr. Ogletree married his son and his son's husband and has been charged with violating the Book of Discipline of the United Methodist Church. That's not really a new story. What is new for me, I confess, has to do with the bishop who is pursuing these charges. That's what happens. The charge comes to the bishop, and the bishop says, yes, these charges can go forward, or no, they cannot, and has to exercise ecclesial privilege or something to dismiss them. The bishop, Bishop Martin McLee, is my friend. Martin was a DS in our annual conference before he was elected bishop. Martin was a member of the delegation that went to General Conference. Martin was a person at whom I threw myself when I was sobbing at General Conference, who held me while I cried, and who went on the floor for me and voted in my place when I could not because I was exhausted or emotionally wrung out. Martin was somebody I told other people about because I was so excited that he was nominated for bishop. I wept with joy when he was elected. I threw myself at him yet again in this big, huge hug that was actually very painful for him because he needed knee surgery and I almost knocked him over, but he forgave me for that. He is a wonderful man and human being and Christian, and he has taken this action to push these charges forward, which is something that is painful to me, that I find difficult and painful. I confess that in the past I have not responded well or favorably to bishops and others who have done this, who have taken this action, who have pursued these charges. I confess that I am biased and that this time it's different because it's my friend and somebody I know and love personally, and that maybe the true challenge is to extend love and grace to those that are not our friends, that we haven't met, with whom we don't have a personal connection. But I find myself today and this week holding those tensions in my heart. Something that I disagree with, that hurts me, and someone that I love, and whom I can't dismiss and condemn and despise. And I feel those shackles on my heart shaken a little bit, hopefully over time, to their foundation. That we might extend one another the compassion, no matter what has happened, to grieve, to mourn, to bury the dead. That we might extend one another the compassion to gather and heal, to wash and tend wounds. That we might extend one another the compassion to forgive, to see that what binds us and the commitments that we keep are complex and complicated, and the love we have for one another is complex and complicated too. The story in Acts is a story of the breaking of chains, and there are literal chains in the story, but they are only the beginning. They are only the surface level. The true power of God lies not in breaking chains made out of metal that bind our feet. The true power of God lies in breaking chains around our hearts that cause us to stay in place out of love and compassion that others might not be hurt, that cause us to welcome and bind, tend and care for and bind the wounds of those whom we have perhaps injured ourselves. The true power of God lies in the breaking of the chains around our hearts, the things that keep us from being loving with one another. The true power of God lies in breaking down the walls and leading us to hospitality and compassion and healing. Amen.